We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short.
Hello, welcome to the Reshape Study Series for the Association of Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. This is a new mini in conversation series that will explore the Reshape Study and the impact of its findings for parents, teachers, policymakers, and mental health professionals. I'm Clara Faria, an ACAM Young Person Ambassador, and today I have the pleasure of interviewing Professor Tamsin Ford, Professor of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the University of Cambridge, and Lauren Cross, a PhD candidate at the MRC Epidemiology Unit, also in the University of Cambridge. Reshape, or Reflecting on the Impacts of COVID-19 on Children and Young People, is a large study looking at how life changed for children, young people, and parents in England during the lockdown, and how this may have affected them. This is a follow-up study from the National Survey of Mental Health and Well-being of Children and Young People, or MHCYP for short, and is a joint effort between the University of Exeter, the University of Cambridge, King's College London, and the NHS. In this episode, we will focus on young people and parents' lockdown experiences during COVID and their reintegration back into pre-pandemic routines. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review and share with friends and colleagues. Welcome, Lauren and Tamsin. Thank you so much for being here today. Can you each start with an introduction, giving a short overview of what you do?
So I'm Lauren Cross. I come from a teaching background and formerly worked as a research assistant on the Reshape study. I'm currently undertaking a PhD, and this is exploring participation experiences in school-based health prevention research.
And my name is Tamsin Ford. I initially trained in the NHS to be a child and adolescent psychiatrist. And then, having completed that training, went back to school and did my own PhD and became an epidemiologist. And so my research and my research group focus on how we optimize interventions and services to support children's mental health.
Thank you so much. There have been some studies looking at the impact of lockdowns in children and young people's mental health with different findings. Some suggested restrictive measures were responsible for worsening young people's mental health, while others found that for certain groups, lockdown was associated with improved mental health. How did you make sense of these findings when planning the study you conducted for Reshape?
So I have been involved all the way through my academic career with the National Survey Series. These have been commissioned by the Department of Health and were to address the problem for government of how many children out there have an impairing psychiatric disorder or mental health condition that needs treating. The first was in 1999. There was one in 2004 and then a big gap till 2017. And in fact, myself and a colleague, Tamsin Youlove Delgado, who I think you can see in other podcasts in this series, were pushing the Department of Health to follow up the 2017 sample. And Tamsin got some funding and a fellowship to do this. And we were just organizing this when the pandemic started in 2020. And it made such sense to pivot what we were doing away from the initial plan, but it needed more funding, towards a follow-up of children's mental health in the pandemic, because of the fact that, okay, it was 3 years before, but we did have a well-described probability sample rather than the convenience sample. And actually, at the time we were planning the study, so it was funded by the Medical Research Council, and it was deliberately a little bit vague that we would do a couple of questionnaires and that we would do deep dives into the detail of people's experience. We could do a couple with each of the surveys that we did. And we didn't specify what we were going to do with those because we wanted to be able to respond to what the policy problem was. However, we decided very quickly from early reports that lockdown experience seemed to vary, and therefore it seemed a very important thing to learn more about, partly because different samples, different ways of getting data, that the initial data was so very varied. So it seemed like this was a really good sample where we knew a lot about their background, where we could make sure, as far as possible, we got a range of people from a range of areas with a range of experiences to make sure that we reflected across all the different pandemic lockdowns that were happening. Because I think the take-home message is just how varied it was for families. As I think people said at the time, we might all have been weathering the same storm, but we were not by any means in the same boat to try and get through it.
Can you tell us a bit about this reshaped study design and how you selected the young people that were going to take part in this specific lockdown experience study?
So we thought it really interesting to explore the variation that we saw in our very first follow-up survey, where we asked people a question about how was lockdown for you? And then there were 5 points people could answer from very much worse to very much better. And yes, quite a lot of people said that lockdown made their life worse or much worse. However, there was a sizable chunk of people, even those who were struggling with their mental health, who said lockdown had made their life better. And that seemed really important to explore in a qualitative fashion, so in conversations with people. So this was one of the first studies that we did. That question was asked in 2020. Anyone who had said in that survey that they were happy to respond to further calls for research, and who wasn't in a different study, we were asking about service use, where it was more important to get everybody who'd access services. And so that slightly limited us, was eligible. And then we took what's called a purposive sample. We tried very hard to make sure that we had the whole range of experience from much worse to much better represented. We wanted to make sure that we had young people, but we also had parents talking about younger children. So the parents were talking about children between the ages of 5 and 18, and the young people were secondary school age up into emerging adulthood, into their early 20s. And there was a bit of a delay. It took almost a year to have the contact details from NHS Digital. In a way, that enhanced the study because it meant we'd been through more than one lockdown and could ask about reintegration, which turned out to be really important later on. And we targeted people who are less represented in research, particularly those of lower socioeconomic status, to try and make sure that we really didn't just get the usual suspects speaking to us.
One of the strengths of the study, in my opinion, is that your research team is so diverse. We have Yu Tamsin, that is an epidemiologist. We have Tamsin New Love, you mentioned before, who brings in a public health perspective. And Lauren, you mentioned your background of education as you were a former teacher. How did you draw from that experience when planning the study questions and investigating lockdown experiences in young people?
Yeah, we also had, I would say, even wider strengths in our team in terms of we have people who were providing a caregiving role during the pandemic. We had those who had been a student and had experienced educational disruption. So we really did have quite a wide perspective of experiences to draw upon. And we took quite a discursive approach to developing things like our topic guide, also reflecting on sort of initial themes as they had emerged. And I think that richness of experience and different perspectives, so how I would see things as a teacher and what I would have done had I been in that situation versus the parent on the other side, was sometimes very different. So I think having those conversations were really useful alongside doing some public involvement work to kind of get a flair of what was going on in that time.
That's really interesting. And the idea of doing a qualitative study to better understand young people's diverse range of experiences is indeed brilliant. Regarding the timing of the study, when were the interviews conducted? And were there any unexpected challenges you've encountered? You just mentioned the PPI work you did. How was conducting that PPI work during the pandemic, Lauren?
So the study itself was conducted in terms of the data collection period over 4 months. So this was between November 2021 and March 2022. If you think back, this was a time when, although many public health measures remained. For example, we were still wearing masks, and there was some concern over a novel variant of COVID-19, but life was largely returning to normal, or at least a version of normal during this phase. And in terms of challenges encountered, I think needing to be flexible with scheduling, with many of the interviews being conducted in evenings and weekends to fit with participants' preferences and schedules, was a logistical challenge. But as with the PPI that you mentioned, all interviews and sort of public involvement had to be conducted over the phone or online, which meant it was harder or took a little bit longer maybe to build rapport, which is such a valuable element within qualitative research, having that sort of give and take and that relationship, especially when you're tapping into people's lives and experiences, and particularly with young people who are perhaps less familiar or comfortable with an interview setting. And I remember at the time, it was one of the things we discussed within our team meetings. And one of our co-authors, Alex Hartley, who was a student who had experienced educational disruption, he was our resident sort of young person, said something which I think is really insightful, that for him and young people, interviews and the word interviews feels like a scary thing. It's something you do for job opportunities or sort of universities, and you feel like there's a right or wrong answer and a pressure to do well. So maybe there is something interesting about the framing of the methods that we use that's important to participant experiences, that maybe that's my PhD coming into the sort of reflection of my previous experiences as a research assistant there.
I love that you pulled a bit from your current PhD work, and I'm also really curious to know more about that, because it's interesting that you mentioned what Alex said about interviews being scary, because as a young person, I found them scary too. Definitely, it has a connotation of something more formal, and building that rapport with participants online must have been a challenge indeed. After you conducted the interviews and you did your analysis, what were the key conclusions and what would you say are the study main findings? And did anything come up in the conversations that you were not expecting?
There were three major themes came out: learning experiences, emotions and coping, and then decompression and discovery. I think we did find what the preliminary research was showing us, and we sampled in order to try and have access to the breadth of experience, that actually the experience was very variable. I'd have worried if we hadn't found that. I think what we were surprised about, because we were doing a separate education-based study, was the emphasis that came through from the participants on education as a kind of major, major focus of worries, of access, of just the importance of school and education to these young people and to the parents and their children. And, you know, access to engaging learning environments was obviously key, but participants also emphasised the importance of social and familial connections, which we had expected. There's some fabulous work from Helen Millis and others in Glasgow demonstrating it over the first few months, where they studied some families and then they went back, that where there were adequate resources and where people could work from home and they had access to equipment and some were quiet to work, actually people were really valuing this time together. Whereas the families where that wasn't the case, maybe they didn't have Wi-Fi, maybe there were problems with mental health in one or more members, or substance misuse, sometimes violence, the things very rapidly began to get into a vicious circle. So we were expecting to get a range, and we were expecting social and family connections to be important. I think what I hadn't expected, but again, others were beginning to report it, was also the importance of structure and routine. And that's an important learning point, because that is something that could be a public health message, that schools and public health messages and advice and support for parents could be about the importance of trying to get a new routine going in order that people have a rhythm to their time, it is important to us as human beings, and that people are sleeping adequately and eating and exercising. I will stop there. Lauren, is there anything you think I've missed or anything you'd like to amplify?
So one thing which I would like to pick up on, or just really stood out for me as a former teacher, is the experiences surrounding learning in lockdown, and particularly surrounding engagement versus efficiency. So lots of participants were reporting it was actually way quicker. They could get through all of their school day's work within the morning and then do other things. But at the same time, they felt uninspired, and the word chore was used when describing those learning experiences. So I think that's really interesting as a teacher in terms of thinking about the role of schooling and how we learn. And is it just sort of taking in knowledge, in which case this is more efficient, that if you're talking about inspiring passions in a subject, then it's not necessarily the most effective method, and you do need that sort of engagement and interaction and discussion around topics. So that for me as a former teacher was very interesting. But other things to pick out on, I think, are surrounding help seeking. Some things are things that unfortunately we classically have come to expect in terms of provision. So knowing where to access support isn't always clear. And then when you do get down the pathway of accessing supports, particularly around mental health and well-being, it can be reported to be impersonal, or the services themselves are overwhelmed. But I also found it interesting that some young people were reporting a preference to self-problem solve. And I think we don't necessarily have services which are set up to facilitate self-problem solving. Tamsin, maybe you're a better person to come in on this, but it's interesting in terms of there seems to be, on one hand, services being overwhelmed and people not being able to access them, but on the other hand, people saying they'd rather self-problem solve and we don't have services set up in that way.
I think it's a very astute observation. It's really interesting to hear that. So from other studies, for example, the IMPACT trial, an NIHR funded trial of different psychological therapies for depression in young people, a vast number of young people had one or two sessions and then didn't come anymore. And actually, they were followed for up to 18 months and was doing fine. So dropping out of treatment actually was a rational decision for them. It's like, thanks, that's all I needed. And I do think that we try and give everyone a Rolls-Royce service when in fact, some people, all they want and need is a couple of steers and a bit of support about how to disentangle a particular situation or predicament that they're in. They don't want weeks and weeks of therapy. So I think we need to get better at matching what we provide to the needs and the desires of the individual person. And not everybody needs 12 weeks of CBT. Some people maybe just need an hour long conversation to have the time and space to think with someone about what is the problem and what they might do about it, and then would welcome the space to go away and try and sort it out for themselves.
It's so interesting that both of you mentioned that, and that some young people reported that they wanted more self-directed help, because it just reminded me of the work of a researcher here in the UK, Maria Lodis. She just gave a lecture in CHARM very recently, and she's doing lots of work around single session interventions for young people, which is exactly this case. I don't know if you want to comment more on that, Tamsin.
She's looking at this kind of single session approach. And, I think at the moment, the system is overwhelmed. It's hard to get the intensity going for those that do need weeks as opposed to more than one or two sessions. And actually, we might do a lot better by many more young people if we offered less in the first instance. And that might actually free up capacity for those with more complicated and difficult problems who need that Rolls-Royce treatment. I think we need to really think very hard about how we organise and deliver mental health services in this country, because, where waiting lists exceed a year or more, that is a dreadful situation for young people. It's a dreadful situation for those caring for them, whether they're practitioners or their family. And young people pay a very heavy developmental price, potentially, if they're not functioning for, say, a whole academic year. So what you want is a system that can offer something quick and simple that for many people might be sufficient. So, yes, I'm really interested to see the outcome of Maria Lowe's current work. Can't wait for her to get through her trial.
And going back to Reshape findings, one of the key areas you identified in your analysis is navigating range integration. And you even commented about the importance of routine as one of the topics that came up. Do you have any particular insights from those interviews or factors that came up that helped explain a successful reintegration for young people? Maybe something that we can convey as a public health message to parents and carers?
Yeah, I think to educators as well. I think communication and compassion are two words which come into mind, and particularly in terms of reintegration into educational settings, but also social spaces. Experiences really did vary, but there were some amazing examples of educational settings doing these two C's really well, sharing videos of the environment, walking through one-way systems, introducing staff members and explaining what and why, which is important, things might look different ahead of time before sort of young people got there. And as things were evolving, I think that's a really good example of good practice that we saw in our interviews. And then on the compassion side, I think allowing an adjustment period, perhaps with a phased return, so you can slowly build up interactions and sort of going back to school, for example, would be really valuable. So it's not everything happening at once. Some of our participants described this sort of period where all of those milestones of growing up, whether it was just like going to gigs or it was driving lessons or sort of flirting with girls or boys, all of these things. And then you sort of get put back into a situation where this is happening all at one time when it would normally be in a spread out period. That was quite intense. And I think employing discretion and kindness surrounding how rules and restrictions were enforced, I think, was coming out as being particularly important. And that's particularly in the context when rules were new or were constantly changing. And let's face it, it happened a lot. So it was a constantly sort of dynamic period and it was very confusing. So having a little bit of leeway, I think, when that was happening was really important. And finally, I would reflect from doing these interviews that the temptation sometimes was to prioritize academic content catch up. So taking the time to really reflect and process experiences, doing some skill development work and creating a safe space to say, I'm not okay, could really make a difference when it comes to integrating back into these spaces.
Thank you, Lauren. And still on the study's findings, other areas you identified as key were emotions and coping. I'm curious about which factors were identified by the young people and the parents as helpful for increasing the ability to cope. Did anything surprise you? Like the interviews with the parents were really different from the interviews with the young people?
I'll start, but again, I'd really welcome Lauren's view on this. Again, the variedness of people's experience. And I think those who cope well in lockdown sometimes didn't find it so easy to reintegrate. And the other way around, there were some who really struggled during lockdown who then were like chomping at the bit to be back and found that bit really easy. So we shouldn't think that there was just one experience that was either negative or positive. Each individual's experience varied. And I guess, going back to an earlier question, this is why the studies initially that were taken at different times from different samples were coming up with such widely differing findings. The fact was that all of that was going on for different people at different times. I think the fact that some people really found it a valuable time for reflection and self-discovery and the kind of being out of the pressure of everyday life was something I hadn't expected to find reported by young people. I think also what we need to bear in mind is, and you know, some comments really summed it up, that actually children missed out on a lot of developmentally important experiences that you don't get when you're just with your family. So there's a quote, which I won't be able to say verbatim, but essentially a mother who had a child who would have been in the survey, he was primary school age, but also had a preschool child who missed out on nursery, on mother and toddler groups, just had much less contact with other children, was saying he's less confident. You know, yes, he's back, he's in school now, and he didn't miss any schooling, but actually he's less confident in social situations than his sibling is. And I think also in the teenage years, those young people who were early on in their secondary school career, perhaps transitioning into that environment, missed a couple of years of slowly developing skills at how you socialise in a much bigger, you know, the social demands of a secondary school compared to a primary school are hugely different. And normally steps are taken to ease year sevens or the first year into it because people recognise it's such a step. But there are a group of kids who went essentially straight from the top end of primary school into the middle of their secondary school career with all the hormonal changes that have gone on. And suddenly they're faced with this environment. I'm not surprised some of them found it really hard to reintegrate. And I'm also not surprised some of them were like, I need people. Lauren, I don't know if you have anything you would like to add.
Yeah, I think there are lots of really interesting comments about it, people being 2 years on and the person you were at the start to the person you were at the end was sometimes really different, and reconciling that in terms of whether it was school friends, your sort of school identity, university, transitions to different places. I think that was a really powerful message and something I hadn't considered to be coming up. The other thing that I feel young people missed out on, and this tracks maybe towards the upper end of high school and then into universities as well, it's not just social skills, but preparation and preparedness to take exams. So lots goes into that phases. And I think now people have sort of missed that GCSE experience or that A-level experience, and they're now sort of the stage on removed and having to do that. And also lots of people were reporting career development stuff as well. So whether that was work experience, getting a part-time job, sort of doing inset stuff with your university or school, that's another factor that I thought was interesting, that young people were saying we've really missed this opportunity to prepare us for our next stage of life.
When looking at the study main findings, what do you think are the main implications for meeting children and young people's needs in the present and in the future? Do you have any recommendations for future interventions or key takeaway messages?
So in terms of if there were to be future lockdowns or public health restrictions or social measures of this kind, I think the sort of key message and the most important one is that schools should be the last to close and first to open, and educational settings, because they really do provide a very important role, not just only academically, but I think in terms of support and protection of our most vulnerable children and young people. And for times when closures are necessary, we should think very carefully about implementing small group care with trained and trusted adults, and particularly working very closely with vulnerable families. I would also advise that families and educators try to encourage a sense of routine and social connection in ways that are possible. They might not be perfect, but having some systems in place can be really valuable in terms of helping young people get into those positive cycles. However, I also think there are insights from this research which are important regardless of whether we are experiencing a pandemic or social restrictions or otherwise. And I think that is just surrounding the sheer variability of experience. We've said it a lot, but in terms of inequalities, access to resources, help seeking, support available, I think it's really important to just reiterate the point that children and young people in this country have very different day-to-day experiences and very different levels of access to support. Arguably, lots of these things were exacerbated by the pandemic, but they weren't created by it. And they certainly haven't gone away because these restrictions have lifted. In fact, if you reflect on our current socioeconomic climate, arguably, they've likely gotten worse. So our study revealed huge differences in those ways that people were able to live their lives and the resources they have access to. So I know it's not novel, but I think it is really important to highlight that more work is needed in this area and greater intervention.
Thank you so much, Lauren and Tamsin. I think with that answer, especially, we could all understand the importance of reshape study and how your findings are going to help inform future interventions and public policy. Well, thank you so much once again for your time and for recording this podcast today. And if you want to know more details on Professor Tamsin Ford and Lauren Cross's work, please visit the CHARM and ACAM website, www.acam.org. And also follow us on Twitter for more updates on the Reshape Study Series at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. Do keep an eye out for other podcasts in the Reshape Study Series, including episodes on service access, eating disorders, and special education needs and disabilities.
And don't forget to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with your friends and colleagues.